This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The U.S. track and field Olympic team trials began yesterday in Sacramento. There, athletes are vying for the privilege to compete in Athens, as well as the chance to deflect attention from the ongoing Balco investigation, perhaps. John Powers has been demystifying the thoroughly confusing circumstances under which track and field athletes find themselves for the readers of the Boston Globe. In order to do the same for our listeners and for yours truly, he joins me now on the line from Long Beach, California, where he's covering the U.S. team trials in swimming. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Morning, Bill. How are you?
Let's start with track and field. Yesterday, a federal judge rejected the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency's bid to review the sealed grand jury testimony of Tim Montgomery, Christy Gaines, Michelle Collins, and Alvin Harrison. How much hinges on whether doping authorities can get access to these documents?
Well, I think in the Tim Montgomery case, apparently quite a bit hinges on that. Even though grand jury transcripts are supposed to be secret, the San Francisco Chronicle got hold of one in which Tim Montgomery admits to have taken steroids, and that would be the smoking gun, if you will, that they are looking for. Other than that, what they'll be relying on is, you know, other circumstantial evidence like transcripts, training logs, hearsay evidence. But this would be enough, most people think, to get Tim Montgomery banned.
The USOC had been facing a July 21st deadline to name an Olympic team, after which substitutions could only be made as a result of injuries. Now the IOC has changed the rules to allow for substitutions due to, quote, exceptional circumstances, which apparently means that an athlete could be pulled off the starting line in Athens and replaced by an alternate if the court so rules. What kind of effect could this have on the games and the athletes?
Well, I think that's why we're now calling these the highly likely Olympic trials. Mm-hmm. It's highly likely you'll be able to compete depending on what happens. But that, of course, has been everyone's worst nightmare, from USA Track and Field to the U.S. Olympic Committee, to have someone literally in the village in line for the opening ceremonies and have them banned there. USADA has said that they will try to expedite all of these hearings and certainly get them done before. One thing that will help track is it's a second week event at the game, so they get a little more wiggle room. But yeah, this is an extraordinary year. The IOC has never made a provision to allow potential drug cheats time to, you know, either be exonerated or not.
The aforementioned four cases, Tim Montgomery included, will go to arbitration, a process that's been known to take months or even years to resolve. The IAAF, for one, has said it can't ban an athlete from Athens based on, quote, non-analytical positives. Can the courts actually come to a decision in time? And if not, who's left who can step in and make a decision before the games?
Well, the thing is that, and you know, people do forget this, the IOC runs the games. I mean, they actually create countries that don't exist just for their own purposes. So if the IOC decides that they just don't like the idea of someone who may be doped in the games, they can ban them. And, you know, at least up until recently, there has been no court to overrule the Lords of the Rings. What they do believe will happen is that they will have an expedited hearing, and that certainly by the time you get to Athens, these people will be able to run. One of the interesting cases is they do not have a test for human growth hormones yet. They may well have it by Athens. If they don't there a couple weeks later, they will. What you may see are medals pulled from athletes months after the games go if they go back and retest those samples with a new test.
Of course, none of this makes any difference if the athletes involved don't qualify at the trials. How hard is it for an athlete to perform under these circumstances?
Well, that's been the big question, is the issue of being distracted. Marion Jones, for example, Tim Montgomery, neither has run as well as they have in the past so far this year. What is likely, however, is that both of those athletes will at least make it in a relay. The top three go in individual events, but you can be part of a relay pool if you're in the top six. So we will find out over the weekend. That's when the sprinters start. But everyone believes that Jones certainly will make the team. Montgomery will make it in a relay.
On to swimming, John. Will Michael Phelps become, as ESPN's Steve Woodward recently asserted, swimming's Mary Lou?
Well, he hasn't got quite the dynamic, the real, you know, eye-opening personality, the massive smile that Mary Lou did. But what's interesting is the number of gold medals that he may possibly be able to go after is going to be nine. Mark Spitz won seven. at a time when they were a little easier to win, when U.S. dominance was just huge. But Michael basically qualified for 11 events at these trials. He's only going to swim six, but with relay possibilities, that still gives him nine shots. Mm-hmm. And if he wins seven medals or goes more, he gets $1 million in speed up. So there's a lot on the line besides gold medals now.
A lot of Americans may not realize that three-time Olympian Jenny Thompson has returned to the pool after she announced in Sydney that she was retiring. What, 10 medals, eight of them gold, weren't
That's
enough?
Right. Weren't enough. Well, I think one of the things is it's amazing what people will do to get their minds off of medical school.
That's the first time I ever heard that explanation.
What she actually was doing is that Jenny actually did make the team last night. She finished second in the 100 butterfly. I mean, one reason why she's going after this is the one medal she has not won is the individual gold medal. She's been considered the world's greatest teammate. You know, other women give her credit for, you know, putting gold around their necks, but this is the one that she's been missing, and at age 31, this is her last chance.
John, who else should we be paying attention to as the trials go on?
Well, Natalie Coughlin is an interesting story. She could have been the female Phelps at the World Championships last year. She was swimming multiple events, got a viral infection at the worst time, and didn't get it done. She is going here in only two events, the 100 back and the 100 free, but that'll still give her a chance for four gold medals. She is a very bubbly personality, and everyone is really rooting for her because they figured that had she stayed healthy, she might have been getting a lot of the same hype that Mr. Phelps is getting here.
John Powers has covered the faster, the higher, and the stronger for many Olympiads, and he helps us disentangle the rings from time to time here on Only a Game. He joined us this time from Long Beach, California, site of this year's Olympic swimming trials. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
During last month's NBA draft, all eyes were on top picks Dwight Howard, Emeka Okafor, and Ben Gordon, but little attention was subsequently paid when Charlotte signed free agent Arthur Johnson, Toronto landed Desmond Farmer, and Damian Wilkins caught on with the Milwaukee Bucks. Although these undrafted rookies don't receive the same hype that big-name players generate, they are essential to clubs looking to fill out summer league teams, training camp squads, and once in a while a complete regular season roster. From member station KUOW in Seattle, John Moe reports.
Power forward Ben Wallace's efforts in leading the Detroit Pistons to a championship had special meaning to the dozens of unheralded rookies toiling away in the NBA's summer leagues. Like many of them, Wallace was initially passed over in the draft. Indeed, very few NBA roster spots are open for first-year players, and most of those are filled by the 59 annual draft picks. Still, a select few undrafted rookies managed to make regular season rosters, including Richie Fromm, who spent last season with the Seattle Supersonics.
To be an undrafted player to make the NBA, there is no formula. I think it's for each person to figure out what they do best and try to do that as best as they can. If they didn't see you as an all-around player out of college, chances are you're not going to be coming in and stepping in and taking 15, 20 shots a game. So you need to be able to come into a game 2 minutes here, 2 minutes there, and to be able to provide some kind of spark for that team. But other than that, I think there's a lot of luck involved as well. You know, you got to be in the right situation, the right team.
Fromm's status as the all-time three-point leader at Gonzaga University aided his cause in making the Sonics. John Weisbrod, the general manager of the Orlando Magic, says that having a specific skill, such as three-point shooting or rebounding, can improve the long odds for undrafted players.
If you get guys that make it all the way through the draft without getting picked, then generally speaking, you know they're not complete players. You know, there's obviously something that caused them not to be drafted, but I think you can find some nook and cranny guys that have one particular NBA skill, even if they're not a complete player. Very often that gives a kid a better chance of making it than a kid that's just sort of above average in a lot of areas.
Boston Celtics general manager Chris Wallace says that going undrafted, while a blow to the ego, can actually give some players a better chance of finding a team they can stick with.
Their agent can sit back and survey the field, find a team that has the greatest need and the greatest desire for their client, and sort of fine-tune and individually tailor an entry into the NBA as opposed to a player who gets selected by a team, particularly in the second round where there's no guaranteed money, may go to a team that's not a good fit for him.
Fromm failed to make the team in two previous tryouts with Portland, but says that being a long shot has made him even more determined to stay in the NBA.
And ever since that day, I just felt like I had to prove myself again every day in practice, and that's the main thing. You can't let up, and you basically got to play almost flawless, but you can't worry about that as well. You just got to go out and do your job and let the chips fall where they may.
Marquise Daniels slipped through both rounds of the 2003 draft after a solid career at Auburn University, but signed as an undrafted rookie with Dallas. Undeterred by the Mavericks' deep roster, Daniels was motivated to prove that every team in the league made a mistake by not drafting him.
I put a lot into it and I worked hard, and I just felt like I got overlooked. Sometimes that happens. Just wherever I went, I was going to make a statement, just show everybody that, you know, I felt like I should have belonged in this league. I just had to come in and work. I mean, nothing's promised in this league. You still got to go in and work for it.
Daniels averaged 8 points and 2 rebounds in 56 regular season games and 15 points and 6 rebounds in 5 playoff games, an improvement Daniels recently parlayed into a 6-year, $38 million extension with Dallas. But his case, along with that of Ben Wallace and a handful of others, is a rare one. While first-round players receive guaranteed 3-year contracts, there are no guarantees for the undrafted. Richie Fromm was selected by the Charlotte Bobcats in the recent expansion draft, a selection that meant he became an unrestricted free agent. And the process of trying to make the Charlotte roster or that of another team will begin again. He's hoping to stick around the NBA after 2 seasons overseas.
I've been to the Philippines in my first one, then I went over to Milan last year after I was cut by the Blazers, or before, you know, because I didn't think I was going to get invited to training camp, so I went to Milan, which is a great job, you know, overseas, and they didn't want to sign me because some kind of insurance situation, and so during that time, the Blazers called me and invited me back to training camp, played there, and then after that, I went to Istanbul, Turkey, after I was cut in training camp, so I'm not done yet. You know, I found out that, you know, I could play at this level, and now it's just a matter of finding an opportunity and a team that needs your minutes. And right now, I think I'm in a long line, but I'm going to persevere and try to make it happen.
For Only a Game, I'm John Moe in Seattle.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Greece triumphed at Euro 2004, beating Portugal 1-0 for the European Soccer Championship on Sunday. But in robot soccer, Germany came first in both the two-legged and the four-legged divisions. 346 teams of robots competed in the 5-day event, and in each division, teams from Australia finished second to the Germans. The people who designed the robotic players are apparently not satisfied with purely mechanical competitions. According to a spokesperson for the robot event, quote, "Our aim is to have robot soccer players compete against the most recent World Cup winners by the middle of the century."
You're charging power, victory. You're charging power, victory.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a thrilling report from the World Series held just a couple of weeks ago in Vermont. Really. But first, if one measure of a book's worth is the ambition of its author as reflected by the book's title, Franklin Foer's new book is in fine shape. It's entitled How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Franklin Foer joins me now from the studios of NPR in Washington. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much.
Your thesis, at least as I get it when the book begins, is that globalization is perhaps more apparent in the composition of professional soccer teams and in the economic workings of those teams than it is in other aspects of life. How did that become apparent to you?
I should start by saying that I'm a devoted fan of the game. And when I would watch games on my television set, from the perspective of my couch, I was watching all these incredibly unusual alchemies on the field. You would have Basque teams with Welsh coaches, with players from Serbia and Brazil and Nigeria. It just seemed to me that this was an incredible illustration of the concept of globalization that I'd been hearing so much about and reading so much about through my job as a staff writer at The New Republic. So I figured, hey, here's a way to put two and two together, and a way, most importantly, for me to be able to travel the world to watch the soccer games that I'd always wanted to watch, and secondarily, search for the reality of globalization.
And you didn't know exactly what you would find, because as you traveled, I gather you found what you term, quote, local blood feuds between soccer teams and their supporters were still thriving, globalization notwithstanding. Does this mean that, for example, fans of the two major rivals in Scotland, Celtic and Rangers, are impervious to the globalization of the game?
I think that's right. One of the things that you hear all the time about globalization, or you've heard a lot more of, let's say, in the mid to late 1990s, was that globalization would bring people together because we were all trading with one another, because we would all be deeply rooted in a shared popular culture. We'd have a lot more incentive and a lot more reason to get along. And so when I was traveling, I expected that soccer rivalries would reflect this, that you would have these big brands in soccer, Real Madrid, Manchester United, plying fans away from their local clubs. Mm-hmm. But the example of Scotland, I think, is a really interesting one. Glasgow, the biggest city in Scotland, has two teams. One is Celtic, and they're the Irish Catholic team, and the other is called Rangers, and they're the Protestant team. And every time these two teams play, all these very hateful tribal sentiments come rushing out into the open. Rangers, the Protestant team's sound system, plays Tina Turner's song, Simply the Best. And at the culmination of this song, you have 40,000 Protestant fans shouting the most nasty things about the Pope that you could imagine. And on the other side, you have the Celtic fans screaming chants about the IRA and blaming the other side for the potato famine. And we could say that we could say that this is all just play. These are just people harmlessly letting off steam, which is to an extent very true. But on the other hand, people die. It's not uncommon for these games to precipitate murder. Glasgow is a town that's not unlike the places you and I live here in the States. And you would expect that all these rivalries would have melted away with time, or at least they would have receded into complete irrelevance. And despite all sorts of globalization and all the rules of globalization that were supposed to have been flowing to their logical conclusion in Scotland, the rivalry persists.
In various countries, parts of the former Yugoslavia, for example, and certainly Italy today, corporate and political bosses have used soccer clubs as part of their political machinery. How does that strategy fit in with your theory of soccer and globalization?
First of all, I should say that the strategy of politicians and businessmen exploiting sport is nothing new. Mm-hmm. Franco, Mussolini, both tried to identify themselves very closely with various soccer teams at various times for political gain. The way that the Serbian story interacts with my thesis about globalization was I was trying to explain the Balkan conflict. And when people typically explain the conflict in the Balkans, they describe it as the unfolding of ancient hatreds. And certainly what happened in the Balkans had a lot to do with ancient hatreds. But it wasn't just that. And I went and I visited the fans of a team called Red Star mm-hmm. in Belgrade. And Red Star had been the European champions in 1991. And at the exact same moment that they were having this great success on the soccer field, their fan clubs were being organized into paramilitary units that went rampaging through Bosnia. And so I went and I asked some of the guys who'd been veterans of these units, and I went reporting through Belgrade. And what I found was that they weren't motivated so much by ancient hatreds. What they were really motivated by was that they wanted to be cool gangsters, that they had seen the hooligans in Western Europe, in England, in Italy, and they told themselves they wanted to be like them. They listened to African-American gangster rap, and that became an important part of their ethos. They carefully studied the emerging Russian mafia and said, darn, that's what I want to be like. And so I think that part of what happened in Serbia was that the culture of gangsterism became globalized, and Serbia just happened to be the place where gangsterism became kind of a national ethos and unfolded to its very grim logical conclusion.
If one soccer club provides a model for how various historical currents and pressures can be channeled into a positive result, it is Barca, the football club of Barcelona. How is it that the, quote, tribal identity, your phrase, of Barca fans has remained passionate without turning dark and violent?
Ah, Barca. Barca holds a very special place in my heart. And part of the reason that it does is that they've cultivated a kind of nationalism there that has nothing to do with the nasty type of nationalism that I just described in the Balkans, or the nasty type of nationalism that you sometimes see coming out of the Basque country. Barcelona shows the promise of a liberal nationalism, a nationalism that's cosmopolitan and inclusive, where it's possible to love your team with all your heart and to love your nation, because Barcelona is a proxy for Catalan nationalism. Mm-hmm. It's possible to feel those feelings so intensely, but to still be civil and open. And the nationalism of the Catalan nationalism as embodied in the Club Barcelona is one that welcomes immigrants and outsiders and has long associated itself with foreigners. It had English coaches at the very beginning. Its greatest player, the greatest player to come through its doors was probably Johan Cruyff, a Dutchman who later became the manager of the club. And it's just a wonderful combination of local Catalan guys with foreigners happily coexisting.
You say in the introduction to your book that you want to, quote, defend the virtues of old-fashioned nationalism to blunt the return of tribalism. Both isms are apparent in today's soccer landscape, obviously, as we've discussed. But what's the most important distinction between nationalism and tribalism within and beyond soccer?
Nationalism has really taken it on the chin over the course of the last decade. You have the rise of all sorts of multinational institutions like the WTO, the World Trade Organization, the European Union, and the nation state has been losing its juice, its power. And at the same time, you have multinational conglomerates gaining more power, and they're very difficult to regulate. So I think nationalism in the nation state has kind of faded. And I think that's not necessarily a positive development, because when people would identify with the nation, it was a way for them to join a group that was kind of broad. At least it could include multiple tribes, multiple religious groups, multiple ethnicities. And so my great fear is that as the nation state continues to lose its power, that people begin reverting back to older ways of grouping themselves, that they return to the tribe, to religion, to ethnicity as a way of defining themselves. And certainly, if we look towards the soccer field, you can see that playing out.
Franklin Foer is the author of How Soccer Explains the World, subtitled An Unlikely Theory of Globalization, published by HarperCollins. He joined me from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Franklin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. If wiffle ball explains even a very small part of the world, it's lucky. But a group of devoted players in the Northeast wish the wiffle whoosh was more widespread, and until that time comes, or doesn't, they will meet once a year in Burlington, Vermont for Wiffle Fest, an event organized by a man with a sense of community and a passion for the sound of plastic on plastic. Only a Game's Monica Brady Meyerhoff has our report.
Nice! Oh, yeah!
For the past 7 years, CJ has measured, mowed, tamed, and chalked a grassy field in Burlington into 10 miniature baseball stadiums. The morning of the Wiffle Ball World Series, CJ's 7-year-old son helps spray paint the lines for the pitcher's mound.
All right, are we in the middle? Is this the middle?
Looks like it.
Looks like it? All right. Go for it. Good.
Sure, there are other wiffle ball tournaments, but I bet none of them have the stadium details of CJ's Wiffle Fest. CJ describes each field.
So Fenway, we've got the Green Monster, which is tarps up on a backstop with a Sitco sign above it and a pesky pole off to the right. Yankee Stadium, I've got a little Yankee logo, just people know that. Blue walls and a painting of the arches that are out in the outfield. Shea Stadium over in the corner has the apple with the Mets logo. You got to believe the home run upside down baseball hat.
Even the kids' field is built like Fenway, with green tarp thrown over a school bus for a mini green monster. This Father's Day, CJ's sons and wife painted 110 feet of cardboard to replicate the brick wall at Wrigley Field. They even added ivy the day of the tournament. Game day, the warming up begins at 9 a.m., the first pitch at 9:35. Oh. CJ mows all the fields himself, shortening the grass in the infield, where a rolling ball, if it's picked up before it stops, is an out. Beyond the pitcher is the slightly higher grass of a single, and then behind another white line, a double. Before the game starts, an exhibition game is played so everyone can ask questions about the rules.
If the ball had stopped, what's the situation? What is it?
It's foul.
It's a foul ball if the ball had stopped before he got to it.
A green lawn chair sits behind home plate like a plastic umpire. If the pitch hits anywhere above the legs, it's a strike. Three strikes, you're out. Two outs ends an inning, three innings in a game. 24 teams play in four divisions. Teams play five games before a potluck lunch, after which the top teams go on to the playoffs and the Wiffle Ball World Series.
Oh, yeah.
It's just the sound, the click of injection-molded plastic, uninjection-molded plastic.
There are some benefits to the petroleum-based economy, and one is Wiffle Ball.
Louis Franco is partnered with his brother-in-law, Eric Thompson, on a team named the Mindless Ones.
We're here every year.
Basically,
because we have played wiffle ball our whole life. Yeah, we used to play one-on-one a lot in his backyard. I play with my brother, like, probably about average of 200 to 300 hours every summer.
They're a team to watch, but other teams are just fun to look at, especially the ones competing for the best uniform award. One team, composed of a father and his 10-year-old daughter, struts across the field in silkscreen T-shirts that create the illusion that Mr. and Mrs. Universe are about to take the field.
Oh, yeah!
We're working on best uniforms and team name.
And your team name is?
Bad to the Bone Buff Buchanans.
This is a game for fathers and daughters and sons and husbands and wives. In the case of the Dirt Bags, a 51-year-old dad plays with his 30-year-old son. The games begin in the traditional way with the Wiffle Fest anthem. CJ plays by the name of Sir Wiffalot with his wife, Kathy Butts, who is Lady Wiffalot. In 7 years, they've never played past lunch. Over at Kauffman Stadium, there's a heated match underway between the Lizards and the Grubs.
Nice grass.
Second and third, one out.
Oh, nice hit.
CJ says he plans for Wiffle Fest all year. When he's stressed at work, he thinks about adding another detail to a stadium, or whether he needs more than the 108 wiffle balls he used this year. CJ grew up outside Boston playing wiffle ball in his backyard. He hosts the tournament because he loves to play, and he loves gathering people together. CJ calls the invitation-only Wiffle Fest a gift to his friends.
Putting this on is kind of like having a big party for my friends, and it's more about community and playing, you know, playing together. Wiffle ball happened to be something that people like to do, but it's more about making a little village for a day and just being together.
Eric Small, a small guy who looks like he'd be more at home behind a computer, comes every summer. He thinks back fondly to the year he won the World Series.
I'm not a big athlete. When we got down to North Beach and told our wives that we had been in the World Series and that we went five innings, it was really dramatic and thrilling.
They were really that impressed?
No. But we were. They were happy for us. They were more happy that the game had ended and we arrived to help with the child care.
The next generation is a big part of Wiffle Fest. The kids' field is improved every year, and games are often stopped when a child runs to daddy on the mound.
Well, at this point, I want to thank everybody for coming today. We're our last game of the day. The Mindless Ones are hosting the CCC Crush for the World Series this year.
The World Series game at Fenway Park is momentarily interrupted by a disputed catch. CJ steps in as the whiff commish and rules it's a do-over. This goes over well with the crowd.
Oh, yeah, it can't be a double.
What did you guys see?
Because that would be totally our favorite.
I think I'm going to play it again.
What do you guys think?
Play it again. Play it again. All right.
We're playing it again.
The mindless ones win 1-0. It's a sort of triumph for tradition, as this is their fourth World Series win. Luis Franco is delighted.
I want to thank my beautiful wife, my beautiful child. I want to thank God, especially for that last line drive that I hit that went off the pitcher's hands and instead of popping up into the air where he could have caught it, it landed on the ground, which gave us the victory.
Everyone helps break down the fields, folding the brick wall at Wrigley, rolling up the back wall tarp of Shea Stadium. And C.J. Spirito says goodbye to what he calls his Wiffle family until next year. For Only a Game, I'm Monica Brady-Myrov in Burlington, Vermont.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a golf course the greens will feel good about. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Are you in the Queen City to gauge the interest in the NBA's newest franchise, the mighty or soon-to-be mighty Bobcats?
I actually gauged the new arena, which is now a bare skeleton of high steel at the moment downtown. But yes, I did see that. And no, I'm not here to survey the Bobcats. We'll let the Bobcats exist before we start talking about
them. That's probably a good idea. Perhaps it was his loss of the yellow jersey during Stage 5 of the Tour de France on Thursday. Maybe it was the crash on Friday, the fact that he's never done particularly well at the Olympics, or, as Lance Armstrong himself states, his need to spend more time with his children. But the aforementioned Lance announced he will not compete in Athens this year. A blow to the U.S. cycling squad's medal aspirations.
Well, as you pointed out, he's never done really well in the Olympics. And how could you possibly go to the Olympics after the Tour de France? That's ridiculous.
It is an interesting question.
I mean, it's not like, you know, playing Doral one week and then Pinehurst the next. I mean, this is a sport that takes a little bit out of you.
Meanwhile, singer, comedian Sheryl Crow in France accompanying pal Lance Armstrong said this week that learning about cycling has been a crash course for her.
Oh, yes, now, if I was really catty, I would point out that Sheryl's probably trying to spend more time with Lance's children, too, but I won't never do that.
Oh.
That's not a terrible line. She obviously hasn't been around cycling enough to know what's acceptable humor and what isn't.
Even as we speak, various U.S. athletes accused of doping are trying to qualify for the Olympics. What's the impact likely to be of U.S. athletes competing in Athens with asterisks beside their names to indicate that they're still under investigation?
Well, first of all, since we represent the United States and not, Iran, there shouldn't be asterisks next to anybody's name before anything's proven. You know, just because the USADA has determined that it will spend the next 6 or 8 months wearing well-tailored kangaroo suits doesn't mean anybody else needs to pay attention to it. Unfortunately, they will. It will be an ongoing story every time certain athletes line up for a final. And whether or not it ruins the Olympics for you, I guess basically depends on where you stand on the issue.
Charlie, you should probably take a bow this morning because I think Mike Krzyzewski must have been listening to you last week. He couldn't figure out why you should leave Duke to coach the Lakers either.
Well, he had 40 million reasons to go to Los Angeles, and that wasn't enough, basically. I mean, the franchise, as we pointed out last week, is in turmoil. The interesting thing, of course, was being down here in North Carolina the week that Mike Krzyzewski declined to take the Lakers job. And John Edwards was named the vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party. Mm. It, believe me, was a photo finish at the wire as to which got more coverage.
Meanwhile, the latest rumored destination for Shaq Diesel is Miami. The Heat have reportedly offered Lamar Odom,
Bryant,
Grant.
Who would he be playing with at Miami?
Well, I don't know.
What young Olympian might he be playing with in Miami? Oh, Dwayne Wade.
There you go. Do these players offered for Shaq constitute equal value, Brian Grant, Lamar Odom, et al.? Is this a good trade?
It's a delicate balance here because you don't want to trade so much that you have nothing to surround Shaquille with if you do land him. I noted with interest that the Celtics re-signed Mark Blunt this week, which a lot of the NBA smart guys believed was going to be the cheap alternative for Miami, basically bringing an adequate journeyman defender and rebounder. But now they seem to be playing for higher stakes than that. If it is Brian Grant and Lamar Odom and a draft pick, it's a very good trade for Miami. If it's Brian Grant, Lamar Odom, Caron Butler, and a draft pick, that might be just a little bit too much.
Meanwhile, the most notable National Hockey League offseason deal this week is the one lavished upon goalie Dominik Hasek, who on Monday signed a one-year, $2 million contract with the Ottawa Senators. There's also an option for a second year. Is this further proof that denial can be a collective phenomenon?
Well, not. I was going to point out that's a great contract for Dominik because he's signing it with a league that may not be playing next year.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, certainly if he comes back and can play anywhere near his abilities, then Ottawa's made a respectable gamble here. I mean, I was more interested in the fact that it was reported this week that the Boston Bruins captain Joe Thornton has signed with a team in Switzerland mm-hmm. in case he's not playing on this continent next year.
Well, speaking of Switzerland, when Swiss citizen Roger Federer won the men's singles title at Wimbledon last year, the Swiss government gave him a cow. This time around, he won again, and they gave him an Alphorn. What if he wins in 05? What does he get, the Matterhorn?
Now, explain to our listeners what an Alphorn
is. It's that great long horn, you know, that's 8 feet long and you have to
weigh... From the Ricola commercials.
Yeah, you have to weigh 400 pounds to get a sound out the other end, I think.
I don't understand whether this is a sliding scale of munificence on the part of the Swiss.
Is a horn worth more than a cow?
When in God's name does he get the clock?
That little cuckoo. Yeah.
Give him a clock! You're Switzerland. You give people clocks.
Baseball's All-Star game is set for Tuesday, and as far as I can tell, the best players in the National League will take on the Yankees. Is that about right?
I don't know. Javier Vasquez was added at the last minute. The most interesting thing about the All-Star game this year is the fact that Carlos Beltran, who's pretty plainly one of the six best outfielders in baseball, won't be playing because they can't figure out what league to put him on. Just slap a uniform. Do the Pele thing. Let him play 4.5 for the American League and 4.5 for the National League.
I have to say that the most intriguing story involving the All-Star game for me is the strong possibility that Mike Piazza will catch Roger Clemens in the All-Star game, lending new meaning to the phrase starting battery.
Well, it may also lend new meaning to the phrase crossing up your pitcher, or in this case, crossing up your catcher. How many times do you figure that Clemens and Piazza will agree on a curveball and Piazza will find a fastball
right in his head, right.
the upper and lower bars of the mask? Can you get ejected for beaning your catcher, by the way? Is that against the rule?
Madrid was the site of an unusual marathon recently, Charlie. The race was run underground along the number 12 route of the city's subway system. But I'm told it still takes more than a token effort to win the race.
Oh,
see, it's funny
and this differs.
The token is,
yeah, that's very good. I'm following your train of thought. And this differs from rush hour exactly how? People are moving a little faster, right?
Well, one presumes that they halted the trains for the course of the race, but I'm not sure.
Hey, you know what? If they want to do that every Patriots Day in Boston, they got my vote.
Jay Leno is rarely stood up by guests, as you well know, Charlie. However, David Beckham and his wife, Victoria Posh Spice Beckham, failed to show for a recent Leno show, and I think the replacement act was a revealing choice.
What was it, Bill?
Performing Seals from SeaWorld.
So let me see if I get this straight now. This would be the mammals who can bounce balls off their head segment of the show, right?
There you go. So they had to find other mammals
right
who could do that, right.
There we go.
Finally, Charlie, on Wednesday, former NBA star Dennis Rodman survived the running of the Bulls in Pamplona and declared that he hadn't been afraid. It is sad, though, isn't it, that Rodman should feel he has to go to such lengths in order to get another NBA team interested.
But what he doesn't tell you is the Bulls were freaking terrified. It's the first time in the history of the event they ran the other way.
Charlie Pierce, absent bull on the hoof or any other kind of bull, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me at this time each week on Only a Game. He joined us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Ed Burke of Keene, New Hampshire, has been getting a double dose of Only a Game analyst Charlie Pierce, having read Charlie's recent Sports Illustrated cover story on Boston Red Sox hitter Manny Ramirez. Mr. Burke emailed as follows. If you never went to Catholic school, as I did, Holy Ghost in New Hyde Park, New York, how are you ever going to really understand Charlie Pierce? We often get email and mail suggesting sports we might like to feature on the program. Recently, Carl of Fayetteville, North Carolina, urged us to cover shinty, a game that he says is like soccer with a stick and is also, he claims, the forebearer of golf and ice hockey. My favorite email along these lines comes from Brendan Larrabee, a WBUR listener and self-proclaimed yo-yo expert. You can contact me, he wrote, except that I'll be leaving for camp on Monday, but my mom can answer any questions. She sounds like my mom. In the corrections department, Virginia Green, who hears only a game on WYPR in Baltimore, wrote to point out that I had mispronounced the Minnesota city from which former U.S. Women's Open champion Hillary Lunke hails as Edina instead of Edina. My apologies to Ms. Green and to Ms. Lunke and to the city's fine inhabitants. Regarding my conversation last week with Jeff Benedict about his most recent book, Out of Bounds, Maurice Cole of Springfield, Massachusetts, wrote, quote, I have not read Mr. Benedict's book, and after hearing him speak on your show, I will not read it. It seems to me that he has singled out one group of wealthy young black basketball players in an attempt to make it seem an atrocity that they get preferential treatment by the court system. Well, Mr. Benedict, maybe you should do a little research into the number of white people who get preferential treatment by the courts, regardless of their occupation or financial status. Finally, Michael Keady of Kalispell, Montana, wrote to say that he would, quote, relish the chance to rally the troops, end quote, on behalf of former Brooklyn Dodgers first baseman Gil Hodges, whom Mr. Keady feels has been unjustly kept out of the Hall of Fame. We'll pass any encouragement from you along to Mr. Keady. You can reach us through the website onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. We're located at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02115. Or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. In Burnsville, Minnesota, construction has begun on a golf course atop a former garbage dump. The new project is designed to collect methane gas created by rotting garbage and to generate electricity for the city, even as duffers above hook, slice, and generate gas of their own. As Mary Stuckey reports, the dual-use project has created unique architectural challenges for the course's designer and for future golfers.
Enormous trucks lumber up a bumpy path and dump loads of household garbage. Birds swoop in for tidbits. This is the garbage dump for the city of Burnsville, Minnesota, a suburb south of St. Paul, and the site of a future golf course, which one waggish reporter referred to as Methane Meadows. It'll be built on top of garbage buried 100 feet deep. Gary Harker is director of recreation and facilities for the city of Burnsville. Harker admits a garbage dump golf course has raised some questions.
The public around here have never played on a landfill before. They're going to be doubting, you know, is it going to smell, what's it going to look like, and so on.
Harker claims there won't be a smell. The garbage will be well sealed and buried, covered with dirt and beautifully landscaped, offering gorgeous views of the Minnesota River Basin. Paul Miller is a golf course architect whose firm, Gil Miller, is designing the course.
Being up on top of the landfill is really quite dramatic. The views, taking advantage of that, coming down to the lower areas and using some of the wetlands and things along the river, I mean, it can be a very unique golf course.
One of the architect's biggest challenges is to build a golf course on top of an enormous mountain of garbage, which will settle and shift over time. For that reason, irrigation pipes must be made of flexible tubing, not stiff plastic, which could snap and break. The changing terrain will challenge golfers to the breaking point, too, says Burnsville's Gary Harker.
Hole number 7 could possibly play different this year than next year, so yes, it could bother your backswing.
Another challenge, the garbage won't support heavy buildings like a clubhouse, so it'll be built just off the course. Golfers will need to climb up a steep incline to the first tee, or perhaps ride on some sort of a tram. Once the Burnsville site becomes a working golf course, it will be one of only a handful in North America that also produce electricity. Garbage is sealed inside a heavy-duty, flexible plastic, kind of like a super-duty garbage bag. As the garbage decomposes, bacteria generate methane gas, which gets trapped inside the plastic. A system of pipes sucks the gas out and sends it down the hill to a small generating plant, which turns the gas into electricity, enough to power 3,000 homes. Gary Harker says this improbable marriage between a recreational facility and a power source is already generating its fair share of humor.
All the jokes that have gone around about the potential of this golf course, no smoking areas, you can just imagine the fun people would have naming this golf course. And there could be all kinds of goofy things.
Maplehurst or Oak Meadows are already out as naming possibilities because tree roots could puncture the plastic liner just 5 feet below the surface. But there will be shrubs and grasses, perhaps some shallow ponds, and a lot of challenging sand traps. Paul Miller says it'll be a long championship golf course.
There have been a lot of courses that link style where there weren't a lot of trees naturally. If people watch the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, a lot of the character of that golf course is through the longer grasses and really the, sort of the way that looks and that link style.
A golf course on a landfill that generates electricity might just be the future for more communities looking for open space on which to build courses. But it'll be a while before the folks in Burnsville know how their course works out because it'll take as long as 15 years to fill up enough space for 18 holes, or just long enough for someone to come up with a name that sticks. For Only a Game, I'm Mary Stuckey in Burnsville, Minnesota.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Thanks this week to Joby Sprinkle at member station WFAE in Charlotte. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, watch Web Wiffleballers, or learn more about Franklin Foer's How Soccer Explains the World, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Franklin Foer, who recalls how his theories regarding globalism, nationalism, and tribalism utterly fascinated former soccer pro Alexi Lalas, with whom he appeared on a recent television program.
And he turned to the camera and looked kind of perplexed and said, "Hey, man, that's one hell of a lot of isms."
Sounds like a blurb for the back of the book to me. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.